So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Rivulway.
Let me tell you about who deserves a shot at the United States heavyweight.
Let's hear it.
I'm the champion. I ought to know. You know, I've been sizing up guys since I came to the WCW. And I think the one guy that stands out the most, the guy that I think has earned a title shot, El Dandy, I think you're a heck of a wrestler. You're a great technician in the ring, and you're a jam-up guy. Whoa. I don't see any reason.
Wait a minute. El Dandy has been wrestling in the cruiserweight division here. Please.
He's a great wrestler.
He's a great wrestler, but my goodness sakes, you're 50 pounds
thicker. Who are you to doubt El Dandy? Because this guy's a serious professional.
Well, let's talk about some serious contenders.
How about hypnosis? Let's get thrown.
Psychosis?
Whatever. He's a great wrestler. You know, you can say what you want. You can try to tear these guys down and take them down.
Psychosis has also
he's
been...
He's a high flyer of the highest
yes,
magnitude.
But he's this still, guy's still a cruiserweight.
Welcome to Review Away. It is John Pollock and Wei Ting, Scarborough's finest export. Wei Ting.
Yeah, that's right.
Welcome.
Thanks, man.
Welcome to the downtown.
Thanks.
How are you doing?
Pretty good. Yeah, pretty good. Kind of, you know, tired, but...
Yeah, we kind of chatted about it Monday night at length.
What did we?
Your big move.
Oh, wow.
How are you? How is life in... Downtown Toronto now, Wei. It's a...
Dude, it's the fucking same.
Like, you are the most famous person in Scarborough that I knew.
What about Mike Myers?
No, you're bigger. You're more relevancy in 2014. Mike Myers, what's he really doing these days?
That's a good question.
He just goes to hockey games and stuff. That's all I see him do.
When was his last big movie? Like his last success?
Austin Powers.
That was it, eh?
He has a lot of hits and a lot of misses.
Well, what was that? The guru? The love guru?
Oh, that was one of the most hideous movies in history.
That might have ruined his career.
Didn't that get the Razzie that year?
Maybe.
It should have.
Yeah. He has a street named after him in Scarborough.
Oh, well, you will too. You know what they'll call it? Ting Wei. Okay. You set yourself up for that one.
No, I didn't.
Don't shake your head.
All right.
Well, Wei, we have a lot of stuff to chat about. The Monday Night War. As we look here at the this WWE Network exclusive, I feel I've talked about this so much over the past week about the network. What are your thoughts on just the news that has come out, where the subscriber numbers are? You do not get the Canadian version of the network.
No.
You have the U.S. version.
Yeah.
But what are your, first of all, before we get to the business numbers, just the actual network itself.
Mm-hmm.
Are you happy with it? You watch the network fairly regularly?
I watch it, you know, primarily when we have something to review, to watch. And I think it's great. You know, I think there's so much stuff out there. I mean, I almost think that there's a bit too much. And I think that's really the problem. I don't think the problem is with the service itself. I
don't think so either. I think that the ones who wanted to... Well, we shouldn't say that. There have been a ton of cancellations. But as a service, for $10,
I think
it's hard to... I just think that there are people that... Maybe it's very much like you identified with your own deal with Netflix. There's so much on there. That eventually, after a while, you just canceled it. You don't have time for all this stuff.
The thing is, Netflix, though, at least offers a lot of variety of different genres. And the thing about Netflix is that there's always new content. And there's always new content here with WWE, but it's a lot of... I mean, what is new? What's new on the network?
Rivalries.
It's a lot of, like... That's interesting, sure, but it's you know...
I actually went to go watch some of Rivalries, and I just... There's certain topics that I just... I can't
The first episode is McMahon Austin.
And you know what I mean? And it's not even like, you know, if there were to be some, I don't know, book written on Austin and McMahon, I just, it's the WWE telling us this story of this and the Raw versus Nitro War, the Bret Hart screw job. I can't hear these stories in the WWE anymore. There's no new angle that they can take.
Yeah, I don't even know if I'd be able to, if I want to hear that much more from sort of a third party, from another source. I mean, besides, who could I actually want to hear about that from?
Dave Meltzer.
I don't even know if I want to hear from Dave, because, I mean, what more could be said about, you know, things like the Screwjob or things like the McMahon-Austin rivalry?
The Montreal Screwjob, like, done. I can't do anything more. I never am going to watch that Monday Night War episode.
It's okay. That's why we didn't choose it.
I'm burnt off. I don't ever want to hear that city's name again in connection to pro wrestling, actually.
You will never go to Montreal again.
Unless it's Pat LaPrade telling me something non-WWF related. I could care less.
Couldn't care less.
That's a big mistake a lot of
people make. I mean, I think that that's some of the problem with some of the original content is the fact that it's so much retread about what's already been kind of topics that have already been beaten to death. And that's why I think I was more curious about an episode like this Cruiserweights episode that we were talking, because it's not really a topic that's been, you know, heavily featured on any of their DVDs. Not even like, you know, going back to Confidential or anything like that. Nothing that was really talked about. So that was something that was kind of unique. But as far as, you know, content on the network, I think it's great. It's just that I don't think there's enough of an effort to be made to tell people what's actually there. When you just simply have a bunch of listings, sometimes you have a Survivor Series random year or November to remember random year. That tells me nothing. That gives me no incentive to want to watch that stuff because I don't know what's on it. Conversely, I think what would be a great promotional tactic is if they simply featured, you know, this week in history, this match occurred. And then they did a great little feature on this Cruiserweights episode talking about the Halloween Havoc match between Eddie and Rey Mysterio.
You see the highlights of that? You definitely want to go and just check that match out. And there's no reason you couldn't condense that into a minute highlight it happened in this week in history.
That was a better commercial for the network than, you know, any jingle that they could have come up with for $9.99. Like, they had Daniel Bryan, you know, the biggest star in the industry right now, talk about his memories as a fan watching that match, and now you can go and watch that match too, which I'm assuming a lot of people either haven't seen or haven't seen in a long time. That to me is more incentive to pay that money to watch. But the thing is, you just show Halloween Havoc 1997 up there. It tells people nothing.
Yeah, I think there's all these little things you could do, I think, to drive people there. I think they've really hit so much over the head, just the price aspect of it, which I think those that
it's
have got
never,
it
never been an issue, really.
I mean, it's not the idea that, okay, if this were $15, I wouldn't get it, but $9.99,
yeah,
sign me up. I think that, I don't know, I'm curious to see how this free month works. Do you think that they are going to get any wave of new subscribers at the end of November that are going to stick around for December after? It's not like you can just log on and you get the network. You do have to physically sign up. Mm-hmm. And I can see that being a hurdle for people who just don't want to put in their information thinking that they might be on the hook for something.
I think it'll come down to how good Survivor Series looks and how good all these pay-per-views look beyond that. I mean, if that's that really is what it comes down to. How good is the content that you're building up to? How good is the content that you're promoting? I think if the November, which it doesn't look like, you know, with the card that they have.
Team Authority? Team Cena.
It looks awful. I mean, even though it's free, whatever, they have to do something big. And hopefully December is really their chance to kind of have a major, major main event. And I'm talking like, you know.
Lesnar-Cena. I think you should do that in December.
Something WrestleMania, almost WrestleMania level, you know what I mean? And you need that every single month if you're going to hook people.
Yeah, and you're going to run out of ideas each month, but I think this is kind of your chance to grab a bunch of people who will at least watch it for free and do something so big that they're like, you know what? I don't want to go through the hassle of canceling this. There's a good show next December that I want to see the main event. Stick around, and then I'll get the Rumble.
Yeah, we talked about that stretch, you know, between, and they can really do it between December and January, where if you get a great show, a great main event for December, people might tune in for that. They'll tune in for the Rumble anyway.
And they'll probably stick around for January and probably through WrestleMania. Then you really need something big coming out of Mania.
I don't see many people, you know, ordering the Rumble and then canceling for a month just to save $10 and then signing back on for WrestleMania.
I don't put anything past wrestling fans, but we will find out. They got Fast Lane in February. That's their new pay-per-view.
Fast Lane. Like car races?
There's going to be...
It should be like a derby, like a roller derby.
Yeah, we'll have the collectors and the expressway, all the different lanes.
Okay.
Fast Lane.
Yeah.
A whole team sat down in the marketing department, and that was what they emerged with. That title, Fast Lane.
I can't wait for the promos, like the week of the event. Triple H, I'm going to cut you off.
Maybe it'll be a Monster Truck Challenge rematch. All these years later, Hogan and Big Show. It's the only match Hogan could probably do in 2014.
We definitely need more cars. I'm waiting for the Monday Night Wars episode about cars.
Cars. The wonderful angles and money that have been generated from cars. Well, let's get into the Monday Night War here. Had you watched any episodes of this series prior to these two?
No, I hadn't.
What did you think of the
I heard a lot of buzz coming off of that first episode, but I hadn't checked it out.
Yeah, I've watched a few of these with some notable exceptions. I've had watching them. There were some episodes where I watched. I was like, oh God.
Well, what? I mean, it sounds like a lot of people, like for somebody like you, like a historian, like and a journalist like you, were you more upset just at the inaccuracies, or did you actually find it boring?
No, not boring. I just, you know, there's some different periods of pro wrestling history where a lot of it was, you know, I was 8 years old at this time, so I really wasn't, you know, in tune with what I watched, but I wasn't as engaged with what was happening. And stuff like the cruiserweights and coming over to the WWE, like that part I lived through, and I saw that firsthand, as did you, about what happened. So we will get into it, but I think more it's just... I don't know if it's the WWE just has a certain... It's a very simplistic view of a lot of things. Like, I watched the Goldberg episode, and it's just... It's so simplified into, well, he wasn't... It was a dumb idea to end the streak, but he wasn't a diverse character, and he flopped, and he couldn't make it. And that's such a simple view of how this guy was horrendously booked in 2000, when he was the only thing they had in terms of a ratings draw in 2000, and how they just completely destroyed this guy. Mm. And it's just such a simplistic look that they're, you know, they just
have like a one sentence narrative.
Very much so. And they're talking about, you know, well, the fact is, Randy Orton says, couldn't do a 20-minute match, and you need to do a 20-minute match. I'm like, really? Because I've watched plenty of guys, such as Hulk Hogan, who I'm watching on this fucking thing, who, you know, you book these guys to their strength. Hulk Hogan, when he had to, did a 20-minute match, but he was not in his best light when he was put out there. He didn't have to do a 25-minute main event every night like a Ric Flair did, nor would I put him in that situation. And every guy is different, and I just hate when they have these rigid rules of a guy making it, and to deny what Bill Goldberg was in WCW and how WWE did not anything close to it, the same with him.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was just, here's a guy that's not part of our family anymore. He's not of any value to us anymore. So he's kind of written off as a flash in the pan. And that's kind of what you take away watching the Goldberg episode.
Right. From watching these two episodes, I mean, honestly, watching any WWE-produced type of documentary, they're not investigative at all. They're not really that type of documentary. They're more like, you know, like a biography channel type of, excuse me, just a little very general overview of, you know, what this guy was. You know, so I personally have never expected that level of depth from, like, you know, this type of production. And maybe that's unfortunate.
Well, let's start off with the Monday Night Jericho episode, detailing Chris Jericho, who, of course, moved over to the WWF in 1999. And we start off the show way with a line that's guy just tugging at my heartstrings here. Give me a round of applause.
Give me a round of applause right now.
Right now.
Jericho said that.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Emphasizing right now.
Right now, yeah.
Because you can't leave it ambiguous to when you are emphasizing this point of when you should execute said applause.
Should do
right
that.
Now.
When?
Right now.
Okay.
Right now. And right now we're going to get into this review.
I almost don't want to talk about it so much because I know you're going to stop it. And I don't think you should stop saying right now.
Wait a minute. You specifically have told me you've got to stop doing that.
Well, I mean, now I find it endearing. Now I regret, you know, telling you about your mistakes.
No.
I don't think
I will drop it. I think I say it too naturally.
Okay.
So I'll keep it alive just for
Maybe
you.
Maybe you can just substitute it with, like, presently. Presently?
Presently.
Yeah.
I have begun to try and think when I'm about to say it, but then I'll go back. I'm like, when I'm, like, in a conversation with someone, like, I'm not even listening to what I'm saying. I'm thinking words ahead.
You never say it in conversation. I've never had a conversation with you where I'm like, oh, he said right now a lot. It's always when you're, like, broadcasting. Always when you're on air, like doing an interview or something.
Do I say it a lot with you in this setting?
No. That's the other thing. You don't say it so much when we're just talking like this. But when you're, like, especially when you're, like, on camera, like in broadcast mode, I catch you.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought I said it just all the time.
When you're actually making a point, like when you're in broadcaster mode, like you say it.
I like that you're so aware of these things.
I feel like we're
Miz and Damian Sandow.
I'm around you like all the time, and I hear you speak like so often, so I can't help it.
I know I said this on Monday.
Do you want me to? I'll point it out next time I notice it. Okay?
We should have like a sound effect, like that bell right there. No, don't do that. Probably.
We could do that.
I'm probably going to have to go to a speech therapist one day and like...
Maybe you had a childhood trauma that has...
Maybe there was something traumatic that happened and Van Halen was on the radio.
Yeah.
That's the song we're going out with.
Yeah, maybe like from within the womb.
That was a song we used for Fight Network Radio.
That could be it. Maybe, like, you drank a lot of Pepsi Clear when you were a kid.
You know what I did?
It was a theme song.
You know what I did swallow when I was a child was contact lenses.
Oh.
When I was a child and I went into my mom's bathroom and she had contact lenses and she had them in those little circular things
you put your lenses in.
And I opened them and I drank them, like the contact lenses and the fluid.
Oh, no.
Like both of them, like they were like a drink or something.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
What happened?
I don't think anything happened.
You started saying right now.
That was it.
Get these out of me right now, Mom. Right now.
Right now.
When did you drink them?
Right now. Oh, boy.
They just pass through?
I guess. They're not poison or anything, obviously.
I guess not.
They have to go into your eyes.
Yeah, but it's a cleaning solution. Yeah, I guess you're right. But that was before, like, the dissolvable ones, right?
Yeah, these were definitely, like, hard lenses.
Shit. Wow.
So don't fuck around. I've had two horrendous experiences with eye contacts. Lenses.
What's the other?
The other was when I got contact lenses and I couldn't take them out. I've told this story many
stuck
times.
In? I don't remember.
I had to go to the emergency room to get them removed.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Never
You're
since.
Like, take these out.
Did you ever have contact
Take
lenses?
These out right now.
Right. Okay. So now you're overdoing it. God, I must be annoying.
No, I've never had contact lenses.
Really?
Gordon just got a pair.
Gordon is one of my favorite people ever. Sunday was so fun. While you were moving shit up to your place, and me and Gordon were just going back and forth. Like he's got so much energy in him, and
Gordon was the boss. Of
Dude's fucking
day.
Yeah. He's yeah. like. He's just like, it was like your dad or something, just like, ow, weighing them. They didn't even want to tie this stuff up. I said, of course we got to tie this stuff up. All this stuff's going to fall. I'm like, Wei Chung, what's going on?
Well, listen, Gordon's definitely the manliest of amongst me
dude,
and my
he's
friends.
Fucking strong,
Yo,
too,
he's
man.
Fucking strong,
he is
dude.
One of the most deceptively strong people. Oh, he yeah. was taking like three fucking bins at a time and just like nothing picking them up.
Yeah, no, he's
what an interesting cat.
Yeah, and he knows how to tie knots very well. I was trying to tie my desk to the U-Haul, to the side of the U-Haul, and I tried for most like 15 minutes, and Gordon just comes over and ties it perfectly in two. Yes. Yeah, he's quite amazing. Happy birthday to him, actually. His birthday was yesterday.
Oh, on Tuesday?
Yeah.
Oh.
It was Tuesday.
Happy birthday, Gordon.
Yeah.
I've already got him confirmed for Elf Night.
Yes.
He is not going to back out. He has verbally agreed, and you were a witness to it.
Okay.
Friday and Saturday before Christmas.
Provided he has no work. Or will he... did you tell him to
No, I
to
told him no clients that day. He is coming out on Friday, December 19th, and Saturday, December the 20th.
Two Elf Nights?
Oh, there's going to be two.
What?
Yeah, I've just announced that.
Even after your Halloween escapades... You're still willing to...
You know what? Halloween wasn't that bad for me. It was freezing, but
I'm surprised you're not sick.
Jason Agnew got sick, but appeared to be much better Sunday night. I did not get sick at all, though I did. I took the subway home, and then the last bus I missed. And then I got home, and I had left my swipe card to get in upstairs.
Uh-oh.
So my own security wouldn't even buzz me in.
And your wife wasn't in?
No, she was out. So, luckily someone came and I just followed them.
Stay over next time.
Next time I could, yeah. I was off by 2 days.
Yeah.
Or else that would have been my backup.
Yeah.
Me showing up in an aerobics outfit.
That would be weird.
Rumors would start in your building.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to Monday Night Jericho right now. There's a lot to talk about in this because Chris Jericho has
First of all, let's talk about the show packaging itself. How do you like the little intro that they put together?
I think it's fantastic. This graphics package is incredible.
I thought it was definitely inspired, you know, by both original Raw and Nitro.
Right, intros, with like kind of the dark city skyline for Nitro.
The dystopian future where there's fire everywhere.
And just wrestling being broadcast on buildings.
Lit oil tanks just on the street.
Sewers being
explosions and projections of pro wrestling of The Undertaker on sides of buildings.
I love that intro, though.
It's great.
I think a part of it is nostalgia, but I always loved it.
It's too bad they can't do more of those because, I mean, especially at the time, the rosters were changing so often. But, you know, it's too bad they couldn't do more kind of film-like introductions to these shows.
Yeah, it's a spectacular graphics package that opens up the Monday Night War. And with Chris Jericho, they kind of just go through his career leading up to WCW. We had Smoky Mountain wrestling footage throughout here, wrestling for war in Japan, his time in ECW, which Jericho notes he only did 22 matches for the promotion.
At this point, I mean, it's quite apparent that the WWE could use any footage from anywhere that they can get, you know? No one. How many people realistically would turn them down? I mean, maybe
nobody.
UFC.
I think they could get UFC footage
if they wanted. I'm sure.
You remember when Brock Lesnar debuted with the UFC? The WWE allowed them to use some of Brock Lesnar's footage, and even UFC advertised on WWE website.
And have we ever seen the reverse? Have we ever seen UFC footage in the WWE?
No, but that's only because there's no need for it by UFC. Yeah. They don't have anybody that they would need footage of, unless if Brock returned, I bet you they probably would maybe work out a deal.
No, UFC has used WWF footage, haven't they?
When?
For any of the for some of the Brock promos, didn't they?
For some of the Brock promos, yes.
Yeah. But has WWF ever used UFC footage?
Oh, right, we're talking the opposite. They've definitely shown. I've definitely seen in some of those video pieces that they've done with Lesnar this past summer. They showed stills of his fight with Heath Herring.
Photos.
Yeah, photos. I don't think
actual video
footage.
What we used to do.
Yeah.
Just like show photos.
Yeah, but this also wasn't Brock Lesnar at King of the Cage or something.
Yeah.
As we preview Quentin Jackson's upcoming fight.
Yeah. Whereas, you know, the conversation, like these documentaries from in the past, I think they would always be limited in what content they can use. WWF essentially owns everything now, maybe TNA aside. But essentially they had access to any footage they can get. And I was just a little amazed at some of the, I mean, Smoky Mountain, I knew they had, but then like they start talking about this, the Inokia, what is it? The World Peace Wrestling Peace Festival.
Yes.
Show?
Which took place in LA in 96, which is the first time Bischoff and Jericho met.
And they had footage of that even.
Oh, you got to track down the World Wrestling Peace Festival.
Look, how often, how many times do you think they'd use footage from the World Wrestling Peace Festival in anything that they do?
Probably not too often. I don't even believe they would own this. It was just probably had footage of it and used it. And that was, that was when Bischoff had been told about Benoit had really recommended Jericho to Bischoff, and then Bischoff went to this show, signed him to a contract, and I think Bischoff like left the show before Jericho even had a match that night.
This show looks awesome. I ended up looking up the card for this World Wrestling Peace Festival. It was
read off the card.
Okay, well, it's
Jericho's long, in like a weird three way. I think
it's a long card. This took place in June 1st of 1996 in the L.A. Sports Arena to a crowd of about 6,000. And it was the Inoki, Antonio Inoki put this together, called the World Wrestling Peace Festival. It was, the idea was to promote
peace.
Harmony for peace.
Of course.
Through professional wrestling.
Through pro wrestling.
And the card, I mean, just starting out from the first match. Okay, well, this won't mean anything to you. Sergeant Craig Pittman.
Yes!
Taking on KGB from AAA. Whoever that is. Jim Neidhart taking on Bobby Bradley Jr. Akira Hokuto and Lady Apache taking on Bull Nakano and Neftali. Basically, these are a lot, like, I mean, pretty much.
There was a lot of AAA involved in the show with Conan and.
Yeah, EMLL, New Japan Pro Wrestling, WCW, Liger versus Great Sasuke from Michinoku Pro. The Giant took on Sting. We had Perro Aguayo.
Which is exactly what you want to follow, Sasuke and Liger, Sting and the Giant.
Well, you know, you got to have a good cross-section of all sorts of wrestling styles. Negro Casas, Hijo del Santo. Lex Luger versus Masa Saito. Rey Mysterio and Ultimo Dragon took on Heavy Metal and Psychosis.
That would have been really good.
Benoit versus Alex Wright. I'm trying to look for the Jericho.
I think Jericho was in a three-way with Conan and Bam Bam Bigelow on that show.
Okay. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, Conan taking on Jericho. Exactly.
Who won that match? Conan?
Conan. Triangle match. And then the main event. Do you know this?
Nope.
Antonio Inoki from New Japan Pro Wrestling and Dan Severn from the NWA defeated Yoshiaki Fujiwara from UWFI and Oleg Taktarov from Pancras. Yeah. That was the main event.
That's how you cap off the Peace Festival with Oleg Taktarov. Peace.
So I mean,
future look, actor.
Looked like quite the interesting show that I wouldn't have really heard about.
One day we should take a look at the Peace Festival.
Let's do it.
See how much peace was actually...
They
expounded upon.
They solved world peace.
Amazing. In one day at the LA Sports Arena. And Chris Jericho was signing with WCW at the time and debuted on debuted in August of 1996 on an edition of Nitro against Alex Wright. And Bischoff notes here at this point in time that Jericho was not refined and... They had, like, Kofi Kingston and Daniel Bryan bringing up how, like, over-the-top Chris Jericho was at this time. He was kind of goofy. Daniel Bryan flat-out says he was lame.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it was, he was lame because he was just a generic babyface. And, you know, they cite the story of the – and Jericho talked about it, too, about how he had a lot of difficulty trying to get over as a generic babyface, especially in a time when, you know, heels were getting cheered. And this was an interesting part of the documentary because this is, I think, a problem that still afflicts a lot of people today, especially newcomers who just debut as baby faces. I mean, it's a problem that's affected almost everybody from, like, a John Cena to Randy Orton to, you know, a CM Punk or even, like, a EC3 you think about today. When they started off, they were simply baby faces who were trying to pander to the crowd with no real identity. And it's a lot more difficult to get over in that way. Whereas, the moment that guy starts to turn heel, you start to see their personality come out. And this whole section of Jericho starting in WCW pretty much talks about that.
Yeah, he was really just not one of the top cruiserweights at this point. He was just kind of a young baby face that, you know, more educated wrestling fans would have known his backstory and some of the matches he had with Ultimo Dragon coming out of ECW. But they just talk about the fact that the NWO was really cool at this time, and Jericho was a guy that they show clips of the announcers just laughing at this guy. One of the funniest clips they had was in a match with Marcus Alexander Bagwell, where they're fighting on the turnbuckle. Jericho does a moonsault off the turnbuckle and lands on his feet as Bagwell's just standing there on the turnbuckle, watches this guy does this flip, and then hits him with the blockbuster. It was just, Jericho just looked like a fool here. And all of this led up to the eventual heel turn for Jericho, which was something he finally had a chance to showcase that personality, and that happened towards the end of 1997. And there was this great contrast that they had, because we heard from Zack Ryder as he talks about Jericho's rise as a heel and says he ended up getting to be cool, and the upper card, they didn't care about this guy, Chris Jericho. He wasn't at their level, so he just got to really experiment with a lot of stuff and got over as a result of it. And kind of Zack Ryder was at that level for a certain time, and then people did start to care, and he was essentially really cut off at that point, and now he's his gimmick is an invisible man.
Who appears on these shows?
Who appears as talking heads on specials about Chris Jericho.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, that sort of that arc is quite common, I think. You know, you have a guy who starts out as a generic babyface that no one cares about. They turn heel, where people start to boo you, but they start to remember who you are. And then from that point on, they start to hate you so much that you become so entertaining and likable, and they want you to turn face. And
it's not all that different from, like, the Japanese system, where when these rookies are coming up, they're not allowed to do any high spots. They don't have any special gear about them. They're given a very small box of which to work on, so that when they allow you that next step, you're so hungry just to add, because you're working in these confines. And I don't think it's that different here.
Do you think it's deliberate, though, in North America?
I don't know if it's necessarily deliberate, but I think there is a thought to it, because it is a pattern we see so often, where guys are brought out as just these white meat baby faces. And finally, they're so constrained in this role, it's so unnatural for them, that when finally you make the turn, man, you probably do have a lot of frustration built up, because you're not progressing at the rate you would like to, and now you're given some more creative freedom as a heel.
I think it's, you know, it's all the more, like, talking about that, it makes it seem all the more impressive when guys end up being natural baby faces. Like, I'm talking guys like Daniel Bryan, you know, who I don't think there's really, in his WWE run at least, there's never been a clamoring for him to turn heel. And I guess largely that comes down to, you know, his in-ring ability. But I think it's so hard to be a babyface.
It's incredibly difficult. I mean, look at Randy Orton, who has, to me, faltered time after time as a babyface. It's such a unnatural fit for the guy. And I think it's tougher than ever to be, you know, that sympathetic babyface. It's a really difficult connection to make. Even the best guys can struggle at it. And they talked kind of a bit about the war between Raw and Nitro at the time, Jericho noting that his goal the whole time was to get to the WWF, said he was pulling for Raw, but he wanted to do his best on Nitro so that they would eventually, their attention would be to bring Jericho on over to the WWF side, and kind of citing that was always the goal. And then the real turning point for Chris Jericho, at least in his mind, was in the fall of 98 when they did the mini Bill Goldberg program, where Jericho just came out week after week challenging Bill Goldberg to a match, and they did all these basically bullshit finishes where he brought in guys dressed as Goldberg. Goldberg wouldn't show up. He'd win by count out, to where he had beaten Goldberg three times. And essentially, he was just let out there to cut these promos, and Bill Goldberg had no interest in working with this guy. And a lot of people around Goldberg were in his ear that, hey, you don't want to be working with this guy. He's just going to hurt you. And it was kind of, that was the last, I guess, straw for Jericho at that point, knowing that this is the highest level I can get to, and I'm never going to get past this point.
I love that they actually had a brief clip of Goldberg from, you know, the lone interview that they've ever had with Goldberg. Or, I don't know.
Oh, with those glasses on?
Yeah.
They interviewed him out in the fucking desert or something.
It was like in his pool. Whatever.
Okay, maybe a pool.
And he had these, like, Mr. Freeze glasses on.
Some of these are hilarious, because it's like they pretty much all of these Monday Night War episodes, they've got the Bischoff interview with the Raw set behind them from 2003. And it was only notable because during one of these shows, they found a new Bischoff interview from 2007 that I guarantee you they just stumbled upon.
Yeah. It's that. And also, the other thing about Bischoff is anytime they just like wanted to, they just talk to him and they cut to a still photo, it's like the same, you know, douchey Zoolander-like pose that he's got, you know? That you'll know it when you see that photo. It's such a...
Oh, I know it. The Bischoff one.
The Bischoff photo.
Yeah, absolutely. The still photo.
It's so funny. Yeah, they also spent quite a bit of time talking about his feud with Dean Malenko. And Dean Malenko I found to be a pretty big constant on, you know, both of these episodes. He was kind of heavily featured as a big part of both.
Yeah, well, he's certainly somebody that's very much part of the WWE system right now. I think they put a lot of focus on him. And I remember when we first started getting Nitro here, and it was right around, I would say, mid-96 or so. Dean Malenko, to me, was one of my favorite guys to watch each week. And it wasn't because he was this gigantic personality or this great promo, but I just always enjoyed this guy's matches. And, I mean, he was the Cruiserweight champion at a time when I thought the whole Cruiserweight division was really novel.
Yeah.
And he was someone that stood out.
Sorry, I'm trying to notice. You asked if you say right now in this setting, and you didn't say any right nows in that setting. But I just found myself, like, as I was listening to you...
Oh, inserting your own.
No, checking for right nows. I have, like, a right now detector now in my brain.
Oh.
For when they go off.
Well, just hit the bell. We would turn people off pretty damn quick with that fucking bell. So from Dean Malenko,
I don't know about you, but like I almost find like, you know, maybe it's the fact that he is part of the system, but I almost find that the producers of these shows are almost making an effort to kind of promote, you know, the legacy of somebody often neglected like Dean Malenko.
Yeah, he's someone that, I mean, if you only watched his WWF run, I mean, not really anyone of note, didn't have anything too significant during that WWF run. His biggest contributions have been behind the scenes. And, you go back to the Cruiserweight division, which was the high point of his career just in terms of notoriety and what he's most attached to. So they go through those programs. Of course, there were the feuds with Ray, with Juventud, where he unmasked him. And eventually, with the Goldberg program, it pretty much culminated, instead of doing a pay-per-view match, they just had Goldberg spear him on the aisle on Nitro, and that was pretty much it. And that was it. That was the program.
Yeah,
Bill Goldberg and Chris Jericho. But I don't know how much you were really going to get out of it. I mean, Jericho was in it.
He's a comedy figure.
He was, and I will say though that at that time they were doing these promos week after week after week. I think you could have done the match. I don't think there was anything against doing the match.
Would you have made it competitive?
I think you could have done 6 minutes.
Of competitive? Okay. Could you have done a Jericho versus Triple H type of match with Goldberg?
No. Like a 20-minute match with those two? Yeah. No,
how much would Jericho really have gained from a 6-minute match as opposed to a squash?
I think it was just the idea of having a guy at that level work with a main event talent, and by them not going with that, it was pretty much an indication that those people that are kind of labeled as their cruiserweights or labeled in this mid-card, you're not getting past this part. You're not going to mix in with the top guys. And I think that was really demoralizing for a lot of your Guerreros, your Benoits, who, I mean, at the end of the day here, how much upward mobility do I have in this promotion? And they pretty much gave a pretty loud statement that you're not getting past a certain level. We have our set main event guys, and we're not mixing in new talent up there. And a lot of people saw Jericho as someone that really started this program on his own. He got some heat with it. There were people that were getting behind his character, but the promotion wouldn't. So I can see that being tough for some guys in the locker room, at least, to stomach. Would it have made Jericho's career? I don't think it would have been that drastically difficult, and I don't think it would have changed things once his contract came due, which was the next part It's where they talked about this really interesting situation where in October of 98, Chris Jericho contacted Vince Russo. His contract was actually coming due, and he had verbally agreed to a contract extension with WCW, but they never sent him the contract. It took like 4 or 5 months for the contract to finally reach him, so he didn't sign it and ended up going to Vince McMahon's house in Stamford, Connecticut, with an assumed name. He was Mr. Stevenson when he arrived at the airport. And then they explained that he went to Vince's house. They were putting together Raw, and Vince is bouncing ideas off of Chris Jericho for Raw, and how the idea of him coming over to the WWF was never brought up during this entire visit. It was just a cordial meeting between these two. If you don't think tampering existed during this exchange, I think you're crazy.
Oh, and Jericho pretty much said as much, right? He basically said, you know, Vince was very careful not to kind of say anything in language that would, break any contractual regulations, but sort of a...
The fact they were meeting
there's a lot of winking.
And there was a lot of tampering going on at this time as these guys were each trying to raid the other's rosters. And
Mr. Stevenson.
Mr. Stevenson, is that your name?
Yeah, nice to meet you.
So essentially in October, think about that. They met in October. I'm pretty sure Chris Jericho left Vince McMahon's house that night, pretty sure of where his next paycheck was going to be coming from. And wouldn't debut until August because his contract with WCW went until the end of June of 99. So he still had a long time to go under his WCW deal. And when he made it apparent that he was going to be leaving, their decision, which is explained here, was that Bischoff was going to take him off television and instead he'll work house shows and he'll do all the live events and he'll get his paycheck, but he's not going to be on TV, which turned out to be great for Jericho because under the traditional method, this guy would have been brought out every single week and just beaten over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder if Jericho would have been as big of a deal in terms of perception if he had been just doing jobs for 6 months coming in and we're going to put him with The Rock. We're going to place him in this kind of a role. We're going to give him this big debut. Mm-hmm. I mean, he might have been viewed as someone way down. He would have been a Van Hammer, maybe, in perception after watching this guy job every single week and look like a goof on TV.
Maybe. He's also, I think, way more talented than, you know, a Van Hammer. So that even if he did have that treatment, I'm sure he'd recover.
Well, look at a guy like, for instance, Chavo Guerrero. He's a very good wrestler. Mm-hmm. But when he came into TNA, I mean, did he feel like a big deal?
No, not at all.
Because we had just been watching him on TV for a year, losing the Hornswoggle.
Okay, but if Chavo was off of TV due to an injury for a whole year and then he came to TNA, it wouldn't have been a big difference either.
I'm just saying that if he had undergone 6 months of just being treated like just losing to everybody.
I think there's still...
I think that would have hurt some of his momentum instead of being off TV and a fresh return.
Let's take a guy like Dolph Ziggler, for instance. You know, he's gotten some wins lately, but for the most part of the past 2 years, he's been losing a lot. If he went to TNA, would it be a big deal? Never mind the fact that there might not be a TNA soon, but...
Well, first of all, he wouldn't be Dolph Ziggler. He would be coming in as Doug Zoffel, and... Doug's awful.
What the hell?
He'd definitely get a reaction when he came in. I don't think he'd be a big deal right now going to TNA. Like, over the moon. Yeah, like, oh my God.
It's a bad example.
We got Doug. What? I think it's comparable, though.
Yeah. I don't even know if we could really make those types of comparisons to today anymore, simply because... There is no number two.
I just think it worked out well for Jericho that they made this decision to take him off TV.
Oh, yeah.
And there was this... It was also at the height of just people reacting to anyone jumping ship.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. Just the idea of this guy was on Nitro last week and now fast forward and he's on Raw.
I think there's... You know, I'm sure the whole internet community, the burgeoning internet community at the time, I'm sure played a part in it as well, because at least I knew that, you know, before he actually made his debut, that we knew Jericho was coming.
McMahon actually let it out of the bag beforehand. I mean, first of all, he signed with the WWF, And then I remember a few weeks before he even debuted, they put up a video of Chris Jericho in a car just on the WWF website. It was like,
really?
No mystery that this guy's coming to the WWF.
In a car? What do you mean?
He was just, there was someone shooting, and he was just being driven to Stanford or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And then I remember, like, hearing on the law, because Jeff Merrick had gone down to the WWF headquarters when Off the Record was taping these interviews, and Jeff just flat out said on the air, like, he had lunch with Vince McMahon, he asked him about the Millennium Clock, and Vince was like, yeah, that's Jericho. And Jeff let this out, like, the night before or something. Whoa, on the law. Okay. Well, so I was like,
I guess that was...
I mean, it was perceived as like, oh, who's coming? And if you were following things, it was not really a big dramatic reveal of who it was going to be.
But I think the hype helped because, you know, by the time that the clock struck and then, you know, the confirmation of the big Jericho word, the name appeared on the Titantron, I think people just went that much more crazy, whereas... I mean, I question how big of a star he really was in WCW just because he was kept in the mid-card and the undercard for so long.
Oh, certainly. I think he felt 10 times a bigger star on that debut than at any point in WCW.
And I think that you know, that hype really helped.
That was one of the best promotional debuts. I mean, the clock was just such a novel idea, and the debut, I don't think it could have gone better.
No, I mean, the clock is just awesome, and I still love the sound effect of that clock. I just always thought it was so cool, and such a cool, like, I love the fact that they kept it with his entrance for so long. And here, you know,
and it was weeks they had that thing up. It's not like they just showed up 2 weeks before. Like, they had it over a month, and just constantly with like, the countdown. It was just a tremendous idea.
How stupid were we to care so much about that Y2K bug?
I wrote that down, how stupid Y2K looks in hindsight.
Did your family buy lots of water? Lots of bottled water?
No, but I was legitimately nervous that night. I remember when it was counting down to midnight, I didn't know what the fuck was going to happen. I didn't know if my TV was going to explode. This was a real fear.
But you do realize that, I mean, we're not all in the same time zone.
No.
So, I mean, by
the Japanese would have been ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And I guess
would have ended, and you would have known, wouldn't you?
Who knows?
Yeah. Anyway, it was a lot of hysteria, and bottled water sales went through the roof.
Oh, yeah. People thought it was over. There was that Family Guy episode where they were all preparing for Y2K, and it actually happened.
Oh, yeah.
They were the world was just in ruins after.
Yeah, so...
Is it amazing that he still uses Y2J?
Yeah, I mean, he'll have that nickname forever.
He will, and it's just amazing that thing has lasted long. Like, I guarantee you right now, if you were to go to a high school, I would think 85% of them would have no clue what Y2K means.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they probably wouldn't.
I've never heard that term. And in 1999, that was, Jesus Christ, every single day there was a new story about how your computers aren't figured to move over to the millennium.
The whole world.
Everything, records are going to be lost. It's going to be absolutely...
We're going to start eating and each other.
Well, I wasn't going to that mass hysteria, but I was very concerned my computer was going to break.
I feel like, there were like computer companies even advertising, you know, like
Dell. Y2K compliant.
Yeah.
That was the big thing that year, was computers that were built with the Y2K chip, that they would call it. We are Y2K compliant.
Yeah.
And people were buying new computers as a result of it, thinking their old computer would be destroyed on New Year's Eve.
So weird. And, I mean, I imagine, like, we'll look at things like this whole Ebola deal very much the same way.
Well, one person has died from Ebola.
Multiple people have. Many people have died from Ebola.
I think in this craze, it's only been one person at this point.
People in Africa, a lot of people.
I'm saying in the U.S. at this point, where they are worried that this thing has spread.
Well, okay, but people have died.
Well, the scare, though, is not in Africa. They are aware that Ebola is real, but here in North America, that's where I look at the scare of Ebola coming and destroying everybody.
It's very real, but I think the fears are still very, very much exaggerated at this point.
Well, I don't have Ebola.
Are you going to buy an Ebola compliant computer?
My computer is Ebola compliant.
Is that right?
Yep. I downloaded it. It's a electronic Ebola. So we go through the WWF debut, the segment with The Rock, and Christian.
His music, too, by the way. They nailed it from day one. I mean, how...
Oh, where it looked like there was actually smoke coming out of the Titantron.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the music itself. Yeah. I mean, his theme song, Jericho's, is one of the best, you know, WWE. I mean, I'd say one of the best wrestling theme songs of all time, in my opinion. I think, I don't know, just the mood is so great. It's such a great... Just a big build up to an entrance, and I just don't see them ever changing it, because why would you? They did change it for a while. The King of the World, cool thing.
The Saliva song.
Yeah.
Apparently, they got upset when Jericho openly said he hated that song.
Well, it's not as good as this one.
And no, it's not. And they've gone back to it. Then we go into the interesting part of Jericho's career, and he outlines this a lot in his second book of how his first couple of. I would say a year in the WWF was just not great.
And that's amazing because, I mean, before he talked about it in his book, I don't, as a viewer, you don't really notice that. You don't really get the sense.
He certainly, I mean, once you got into the fall, I mean, especially right before the China feud, which, I mean, a lot of people were just groaning at that feud, but he wasn't really figured into anything, didn't have any big storyline going on. And he talks about the fact that there was a big transition period here to work WWF style, talking about how the locker room really dismissed him. You were part of the other team. I always find that stuff hilarious with, like, the locker rooms that, like, I can understand the idea of guys coming over here and, you know, is your spot going to be compromised here? But... Yeah. The idea that, oh, you guys were trying to destroy our show and you guys were trying to bankrupt us, it's like these wrestlers, the last thing you would ever want would be for the other promotion to fail.
Mm.
And
yeah.
And you had these guys at the time who were saying, you know, like their mission was to beat WCW and put them out of business. It's like, what a stupid idea if you are a pro wrestler that makes your living. And that's your leverage over there. That's your competition.
Well, I mean...
This really existed amongst these guys.
But the idea, you know, if you're working for either company, is to be better than the other company. And when things happen, you know, that you've seen, like, the people stealing each other's ideas or stealing your talent or colleagues, I'm sure it starts to get personal after a while.
There was this story in his book about... After one particular match, a few weeks or so into his debut with the WWF, where Vince McMahon just yelled at him backstage for how bad his match was and how Chris Jericho wasn't worth the ink that he used to sign his contract with.
Ouch.
Just broke this man down. And he talks about the No Mercy show that year where he wasn't even booked on it, which featured the famous ladder match with the Hardys against Edge and Christian. Then would go through the China feud, won the Intercontinental title, and then talks about how things started to change in the company where there did become that big emphasis on kind of in-ring talent with the Radicals who there were three Radicals that came over.
Yes.
That they, including this extremely tight shot where they're walking down the ramp and you only can see Saturn, Guerrero, and Malenko.
Chris Benoit is basically the new WWF logo. That they've, you remember, like, they had to blur out the WWF logo
and
all this footage? Now it's Chris Benoit's face. I mean, they don't blur him out, but
He was shown on the Cruiserweight show because they just couldn't avoid him.
They get very creative with their picking of shots.
Yes,
they do.
Several WCW performers came over instead of four.
Yeah.
Now, several.
It's always, it's sort of like a fun little, you know, drinking game you could play when watching any network show.
I mean... People, it's like Benoit is such an it elicits such a response out of fans no matter what you do.
And because he is newsworthy. But I think the fact that you know that they're trying to hide it just kind of makes it more fun.
I think that is what it's like. I see what the WWF is trying to do here and try to make me not know who was part of this and that thing. And that's going to, I guess, elicit reactions out of people. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? If Benoit was shown here and they said Chris Benoit came over to the WWF in this time, who would care?
Mm-hmm.
Who would really care?
No.
Is it anything no one knows anyway?
I mean, yeah, like you said, they did show him in the Cruiserweight show. And
no one cares.
Not a big deal.
Doesn't matter at all. It's just extra work for some of these editors. And then he talks about the first time he started to really find his stride in the WWF was working with Stephanie McMahon in 2000, and the chemistry those two were able to have together. And also in that time was that Raw where Chris Jericho defeated Triple H for the title in April of 2000. And it was the Phantom title switch where there was a huge reaction to him winning the title. And Jim Ross brings up the fact that the reaction to that win was evidence that the people saw Chris Jericho as a big star. And that was a funny comment to hear because there was a debate at the time of one camp that argued the big pop was because Triple H was such a hated heel that people were cheering Hunter losing. And then there was another side that said, no, it was because Chris Jericho won the title. And these are the kind of arguments that make me so glad I'm not a professional wrestler by trade. Uh-huh. But this is the shit you deal with. And Jack Swagger with the best line, I was literally in shock. Just a deadpan of a
literally
human delivery.
In shock.
But yeah, 2000, you start to see things changing.
I like the fact that, you know, a show like this was able to... I was actually looking for more examples of them, you know, talking about classic Raw matches or classic Nitro matches that don't really get talked about too often. I thought, you know, Triple H Jericho match was obviously one that was very memorable,
can't watch on the network.
You can't.
Not that. 2000.
Oh, it's not up yet.
No Raws from 2000.
But I mean, you know, it's great that they took the time to talk about a match like that that I don't think gets talked about too often.
Yeah, and an incredible reaction. I mean, Jesus Christ, few and far between you get a reaction like that in today's Raw environment.
Yeah.
So from there, they just kind of talk about kind of Jericho's legacy as part of the Cruiserweights. He says he believes he contributed as much as Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, and Hulk Hogan, and said his misuse in WCW led to WCW's downfall. And then the best, which they do in all these shows, they don't even reference the invasion angle. Like this whole the Monday Night War and what it ultimately would culminate in, it's glossed over, and we just skip to the Vengeance pay-per-view in December of 2001 where Chris Jericho wins the Undisputed title. What a hilarious reaction. If you watch the front row, when Jericho wins the title, like it's not people jumping up. It's literally shock amongst these people in the front row. One dude's jaw is just hanging down. Like they can't fathom Chris Jericho, of all people, won the title.
They're all Jack Swaggers.
Yes. And JBL says after that win, Jericho was looked at as the guy who would carry the company. And that's one of those statements way where I lived through that time period. And yeah, he had the title. He was not the guy.
No.
At all.
I mean...
one of the worst build-ups to a WrestleMania main event in history.
They always try to come up with a happy ending for all of these. And
Kofi outdid him with statements, though.
What did Kofi say?
If there was a secret weapon to the WWF winning the Monday Night War, that secret weapon was Chris Jericho. Listen, I'll applaud Chris Jericho, tremendous performer. He was not the secret weapon that WWF put WCW out of business.
What would you say was the secret weapon?
Vince Russo.
Yes. He's the secret. That's a great
dude,
answer.
The incompetence of WCW was the number one reason that promotion went out of business. Mm-hmm. More so than Austin or Vince or Rock or DX.
That's a great choice. Absolutely. I wait for that Monday Night Wars episode.
They've Vince interviewed Russo. They have new interviews with him. I can't watch that one either. That's up there with the screw job.
But I'd love to see their portrayal of it, you know, because that was certainly a big moment when those two jumped ship.
It'd be a funny episode because you're not going to have any of the talent, I think, bending over backwards to protect Vince Russo.
No.
I think a lot of them it would be, here's the guy who left our company and put another one out of business.
Nor the people in the back, I bet. This episode, really, it was just a Chris Jericho documentary. You know, they kind of tried to make it related to the Monday Night Wars, but I really found that it kind of struggled in that sense. It was a good, decent Jericho overview of Jericho's career, but I wouldn't say that it really had. It was kind of reaching at parts to become related to the Monday Night Wars deal.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, if you've watched the Chris Jericho documentary, you have such a more in depth look at his career that I don't know how many people. What more are you getting out of this particular hour that if you've seen that documentary? you wouldn't be aware of. I mean, I guess you get some different talking heads, different views, but it's essentially a one-hour glossed-over version of his WCW-WWE tenure, at least up until 2001.
Pretty much. You know, and it's hard to say who they're really making these for. Are they making these for new audiences, or are they making it for the people that have already seen the documentary?
That's a great question.
I'm not sure.
Who is your target audience here?
Personally, I feel like they're probably just, you know, thinking of ways they can repackage old content to make new content.
Yeah, and if you watch a few of these Monday Night War episodes, like the replay of a lot of these sound clips, I mean, it becomes pretty evident. Like, you're dealing with kind of a finite amount of interviews that are specific to this subject.
And a finite amount of topics and stories to tell.
Yeah, like this week's edition is an hour on The Rock.
Yeah.
You know, do I need an hour of The Rock and his contributions to the Monday Night War? I mean, yeah, it's
I really
just
don't.
There are only so many topics when you're doing this kind of form, as opposed to maybe just looking at each week, each month, we're going to look at the September of 95, and then we go October 95.
But I kind of disagree with that, because I think there are a lot of topics that nobody has ever talked about in pro wrestling, you know?
Like what?
Well, like how to get over as a babyface, for instance, you know, or I don't know, drugs.
For the Monday Night War?
No, not for Monday Night War.
Oh, okay.
I just mean in general.
Okay.
Like in terms of topics. But, I mean, even as it relates to the Monday Night War.
Well, drugs would be an issue when no drug testing was going on. And there were a lot of casualties from that time period.
I suppose the Russo thing would be unique. But, I'm not a TV producer, writer, whatever. I don't get paid to be creative in that sense. I'm sure some of these guys can come up with much better topics. But, I don't buy that there's necessarily nothing else to talk about again. I just feel like they're probably relying on what draws and...
When we get
Austin
the Monday,
McMahon apparently, you know, still draws.
When we get the Monday Night War, the Midian era, I'm going to be concerned for the longevity of this program. All right. Well, we'll now go over, segues well, into Flight of the Cruiserweights.
Mm-hmm.
What a catchy title.
I thought this was an interesting topic.
Very interesting topic. I agree with you. This was more, instead of just a singular look at one particular performer, it was the entire concept of the Cruiserweights, mm-hmm. which no one is going to deny was a huge reason that people tuned into Nitro. And that was always the argument, was that, you know, you did have that star power and this novel idea of the NWO. But for those that were coming over to the WCW, it was this kind of stuff that I think really stuck people to it, much like when the WWF caught fire. Mike Tyson brought a lot of eyeballs in, but it was all these other dynamic characters that were emerging at that time that kept people after Mike Tyson had left.
It also seemed to be one of the things that gave WCW a unique identity, whereas, you know, even an idea like the NWO is very much based on this invading group of guys from the WWF. All the stars that they hired were ex-WWF guys. Cruiserweights were, at least in North America, at least not even, you know, but anyway, amongst the big two.
It felt like WCW was ahead of the curve. I mean, if you had never seen these guys before, whether it be in ECW, in AAA, in New Japan, I mean, if you're just a WWF viewer and then you're watching this felt like a step forward in pro wrestling's progression, was incorporating these different style of athletes, different sizes, matches that you really are not accustomed to seeing on any kind of regular basis. The Cruiserweights were a huge part of that aspect to Nitro. And they started off the show pretty much looking at the WWF, which was forever nicknamed the Land of the Giants in the 80s, and just showcasing
the who's who of Scott Putski candidates.
Superstar Billy Graham, Hulk Hogan.
It was the Scott Putski Hall of Fame.
The Ultimate Warrior, Randy Savage, which was hilarious because Randy Savage would have been a cruiserweight by definition earlier in his career. Ravishing Rick Rude, and then one of these is not like the other, Earthquake. Which I guess emphasizes never a Putski candidate.
No,
John Tenta.
I wouldn't say so. This portion of the doc, though, I will say, felt very much like that Bigger, Faster, Stronger steroid documentary.
I have no idea what you're possibly referring.
Well, I'm just saying.
Inferring.
It was about as closest to the tone of that as I think we did.
These guys worked harder. Get. They wanted it more.
Yes, yes.
These guys weren't lazy. They weren't playing their video games that night. They were in the gym. Eric Bischoff outlined his desire to just differentiate his product, and that took him to go to Japan, Mexico, and that's something you can never, you know, for the things you can discredit Bischoff with, he always, to me, had a way more open mind than Vince McMahon when it came to trying out different things, going with unconventional talent, or just trying different things. I always thought Eric Bischoff had a much more open mind, and the cruiserweight division is a perfect example of that, and going to other places of the globe that you were easily going to have a control over, because Vince McMahon was not going to be popping in the J Cup and taking notes.
No, probably not. No.
Doubtful.
I love that Daniel Bryan was a big part of these interviews, because, and we know this because this is always shaved head Daniel Bryan. Like he had the beard, but the hair was pretty much completely shaved at this point. So older interviews, but it's great to have him feature in these shows.
And Cesaro, like, they leaned on these two to explain what Lucha Libre and Japanese wrestling were.
But just even because of what Bryan has gone on to, even after that, after he did these interviews, and to the status that he's at right now, it's cool to hear the guy who main evented WrestleMania talk about wrestling as a fan.
Yeah, these two especially are guys that just have tremendous memories of wrestling as their childhood. I mean, there's guys that you can tell are just piecing together stuff that they have heard and what are supposed to be important matches, and these guys who will bring up just obscure things and remember stuff so vividly. Like, Cesaro can recite promos word for word, and I imagine this guy's not being too overly produced in these segments where he's just, here's a topic, go.
There's the portion we talked about earlier where they kind of heavily feature the Rey Mysterio-Eddie Guerrero match from Halloween Havoc, and it was essentially Daniel Bryan giving his running commentary about his memories about watching this match, and I just think it's so cool how, a guy who many people today will talk about creating the same memories when they watch his matches, he's talking about what he looked up to.
Then they talk about the rise of Raw, which they say, since January of 1993, WWE had reigned supreme in prime time. And this was strange. They talked about how the WWF style had gotten predictable and boring. And the B-roll they used for this was of Owen Hart, who to me would be the exception to that rather than the rule.
Owen against who?
I can't remember who he was in the ring with, but it was... I don't know. When I think of, like, the slow prodding style of WWF at the time, Owen Hart to me would not be part of that equation. Then they show the contrast over to WCW, and we hear from the likes of Eddie Guerrero. They also interviewed Beth Phoenix here, explaining the cruiserweights, how they didn't need mic time or big stories because their in-ring was kind of their calling card at the time.
I've seen Beth in a lot of these shows.
Yeah, she was. I think she was clearly someone that was watching at this time, and I guess just they interviewed her, and I guess was more competent on this particular time period than most. Wade Barrett talked about how the cruiserweights were best used when they were kept separate, but Booker then also added the fact that also did label you, and it kind of created this glass ceiling where you were a cruiserweight, you could only get so far. And kind of Ric Flair backed that up in reference to Dean Malenko, who was a tremendous wrestler, but he had the label.
Do you think that that they should have gave more credit to ECW for finding cruiserweights in North America?
There was, like, no mention of ECW in this at all, which was, they were the ones that introduced a lot of these names. That cruiserweight division was essentially plucked from ECW and AAA, and some of those AAA guys going through ECW first. And, yeah, really no credit here given at all to ECW being much more ahead of the curve and introducing a lot of these guys like Ray.
And that's odd, because on the ECW documentary, they give that,
Well, they narrative. Did a Monday Night War episode on ECW's influence, and then they fully talk about it. But now we're doing... Well, now the focus is the WCW Cruiserweight division, so we're not going to cross up our stories.
Yeah. All right.
For whatever reason. They get into Rey Mysterio, who I think most people would associate as the key member of the Cruiserweight division. Just a unique style unto his own, debuting at the Great American Bash in 96. And the fact that Mysterio made his debut that night thinking it was just a regular house show. shows up. It's a pay-per-view.
Oh, you mean he didn't? He wasn't a baby duck that just crawled out of an egg?
This was the best line of either episode we watched. Arn Anderson.
When I first saw him, I thought he was a baby duck that had fell out of an egg. That cannot be a human being. I thought somebody had their kid backstage. Damnedest thing I'd ever seen.
When I first saw him, I thought he was a baby duck that fell out of an egg. That cannot be a human being. I thought someone had their kid backstage. And there were tons of stories at that time of people openly just laughing at this little child.
Baby duck.
And then they watched him go out and perform this match, and it was just blew everyone away.
I mean, I'm sure that's part of his appeal.
A baby duck.
He looked like a, what does that even mean?
He was just hatched.
Okay, but why a duck?
Well, a duck is what comes out of an egg.
Okay. A lot of things come out of eggs.
Listen, it's Arn Anderson, the enforcer.
That's the gimmick he should have had.
Well, we also had Norman Smiley refer to LaParker.
LaParker. Well, it's his American name.
LaParker.
LaParker.
How about Billy Kidman? Everyone remembers him with like the wife beater and jeans. Yeah. How about pre-Raven's Flock, where this dude with the short hair, like, just... His name just should have been Indy.
Yeah.
Like, this jacket that looks like he fucking cut the letters out of and stitched onto the back. What a look.
Who knew a wife beater would make such a difference? Wife beater and long hair.
Long hair and, some work.
Actually, it's funny because after he came to the WWE, he basically went back to that generic look.
He did, and he was taken as an indie.
Yeah.
So Kidman is showing throughout this. And then they go into the Halloween Havoc 97 match, which is really focused on in this particular special as like this landmark match, which was an incredible match.
You know, this wasn't I was kind of hoping for more features about actual Nitro matches just to kind of go along with the theme. But I mean, how often will you ever see them do a story about cruiserweights? And I think this was such a big matchup for the cruiserweight division that it deserved its own little profile, and especially since you had Daniel Bryan, speak at length about it.
Yeah, and they did have old clips of Eddie just talking about, wouldn't change one thing about this match, which was notable because Eddie Guerrero was really well known for being one of the harshest when it came to his performances. Right. I mean, he would do interviews where, man, he would be just. Things that people would praise. I mean, he would just point out all the negatives and was definitely his harshest critic. Mm. So for him to say that, I took more stock in it than most wrestlers putting over one of their matches.
And again, just this segment alone, I thought was, a wonderful commercial for this network.
Jericho also pointed out, a lot of misconceptions that people had when it came to the cruiserweight style, saying that there was a lot of thought put into these matches, a lot of psychology, and the fact that he believed that they were second only to the NWO for Nitro doing so well at the time with the television ratings, which is always something subjective.
Yeah, who could prove?
Yeah, right. But it was certainly, it wasn't a turnoff to people, essentially. No. And then they contrast this. This is maybe one instance of the WWF at least shining a light on something that was a failure for them, and that was their own light heavyweight division featuring Taka Michinoku, Brian Christopher, and then just random names such as Devin Storm, Flash Flanagan, and a man by the name of Scott Putski.
Weighing in at 235 pounds.
Yeah, in his leg.
And this was just... The moment they aired this, like, a bunch of people tweeted us about this. And the best part of it was, of all people on the current roster, who could they get to comment about Scott Putski?
Oh, you couldn't have picked a better guy.
CM Punk.
Well, I mean, I think our attempt at a cruiserweight deal was pretty laughable. I don't even know if half the guys were cruiserweights. Scott Putski.
Weighing 235 pounds!
Scott Putski, an outstanding young light heavyweight.
Missed the point of that one.
Who took into a question Scott Putski making the weight limit for the light heavyweight division.
Yeah.
This dude remains to me this day just a marvel of a human being.
He's so interesting.
Orange. Orange.
Yeah, who would have thought a show about cruiserweights would kind of, you know, really give us a who's who of the Scott Putski Award as well as Scott Putski?
You know, you talk about David Cho being an example of someone that's really broken the Asian-American stereotype. How did Taka Michinoku fare in 1997, which with such landmark statements as, "You jock ass," to Jerry Lawler?
I mean, I wouldn't blame Taka for anything. I still love his wrestling. I mean,
you know. Great manager too, New Japan.
Oh, okay.
I haven't dick seen much manager.
Of his. But I mean, you know, I love a lot of his Michinoku Pro stuff. But you know, listen, when you have this programming, I mean, I wouldn't expect anything kind of that. I don't know, progressive to come out of 90s pro wrestling is what I'm saying.
Yeah, they pretty much just discard this light heavyweight division as something that management was never really convinced of. It seemed they were never really behind this division. They never pushed it anywhere close to where the cruiserweights were. You didn't have the personalities. They didn't work the style that the cruiserweights in WCW did.
And isn't it interesting, you know, how they managed to find this group of people? Like, they just happened to grab anybody that happened to be a lighter weight. And
they took a lot of, you know, independent guys in the U.S. Like, that's Scott Taylor was involved in that. Just random guys. They did go to Mexico for a few guys, like Pantera, who came in. But
you know,
it was.
Can you talk? Like, what was the idea behind, you know, some of the WWF attempts at actually bringing Lucha to you know, the WWE with
at this time period?
What about the Super Astros?
Super Astros was. They definitely had a desire to at least present Lucha, but kind of in their. Kind of their presentation. I mean, they brought in El Hijo del Santo, and they wanted to unmask him right away. And he was like, "No, I'm not going to be doing that. That's probably not in the cards." It just seemed like they really didn't have a great handle on pro wrestling outside of their version.
Was that did the idea of that even come because of WCW? Was that a response to WCW?
I think Super Astros was more just it was an idea because they were dealing with Victor Quinones, and they were able to broker this deal to get a television deal and market things more towards Mexico. But it wasn't a show that was really that long-lasting. And I think Super Astros wasn't as much a response to the cruiserweight division as the light heavyweight division was at the time. But also something you could tell, it wasn't a super high priority for them, the light heavyweight division. It didn't really have much of any kind of run attached to it. They created this light heavyweight title that meant very little.
I think just the name, you know, light heavyweight. I mean, it's funny now because the light heavyweight division in the UFC is like the marquee division.
And the second biggest weight class.
Second biggest, yes. But, I mean, I'd say it's a more marquee division than the heavyweight division. You know, I think it always has been. But for some reason, in a wrestling context, it just, the word light in front of somebody. Like, I think cruiserweight sounds way better.
It's like adding 2000 to the end of a tag team name. Something 2000.
Yeah.
You couldn't use cruiserweight, obviously, at that time.
Why not?
I think that would have been too much of a indication.
It's a weight class.
Well, it was.
Oh, you can't use heavyweight?
I think it's. Well, cruiserweight, I mean.
It's a unit of measurement.
I think wrestling fans weren't as much. I guess entrenched in boxing at that point, and I think cruiserweight would have been too much reflective of we are simply trying to take what the WCW did and create it for ourselves.
What's cruiserweight in boxing?
Cruiserweight is above light heavyweight but below heavyweight.
Above light heavy but below heavy.
Okay. Yeah, so these are even smaller guys.
Interesting. Did they ever have a ruling about the actual weight limit for the cruiserweight division?
Yeah, it was supposed to be, wasn't it, 220 pounds, I think?
Oh, yeah?
I can't remember.
Okay. Well, Scott Putski is already over.
I remember they did a Sunday Night Heat once where Christian had to cut weight.
Yeah.
To get the title fight.
Interesting.
But it was same day weigh-ins, I guess. He got to go right up until the match to make weight.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the look there. Oh, they also, there was this great, someone who's cutting these shows at least has a sense of humor. The voiceover states that the WWF was mixing entertaining characters with dynamic storylines. And as they said dynamic storylines, what was the B-roll? Yamaguchi-san chopping a sausage as he looked at Val Venus, the Choppy Choppy Your Pee-Pee segment.
Oh, clearly,
dynamic storylines.
I mean, you have to be a fan to be putting these shows together.
Very tongue-in-cheek.
And I'm sure fans are, you know, much like you and I, we know a lot of the great stuff and a lot of the bad stuff about these shows.
Yeah. When I think of the turnaround, I think of The Rock, DX, Yamaguchi-san, in that order. Then we go back to the NWO and just beating this concept into the ground and the fractured nature of the concept with the Wolfpack, NWO Hollywood, and then the introduction of the Latino World Order headed by Eddie Guerrero, where he cut this promo at the time where he was holding a cup of coffee, which was a real event at the time when Eric Bischoff like threw a cup of coffee or something at a wall or something near Eddie Guerrero as they were fighting backstage. So Eddie Guerrero came out on TV holding a cup of coffee and poured it on himself, telling Eric, "I'll save you the time," and poured coffee on him.
Okay, so then
no one fucking of the people watching Nitro, like, no one would have gotten this reference.
Okay, that's interesting. But then yeah, they talk a lot about this Eddie's, supposedly legit opinions about Bischoff. And for whatever reason, like, anytime they do something like this, they always manage to find a worked shoot promo to illustrate this point perfectly.
I've made you a star, you punk. You're going nowhere.
You made me the star. I didn't do that on my own in the ring.
Like, how did this
work? Oh, I didn't get to be a star by myself. I didn't do that. No, I did it for you.
No, they always luck out that, we want to hit on this very legitimate hatred between these two people backstage.
The top stars of WCW were not taking this seriously. And then we cut to Kevin Nash getting a massage, and Scott's like, "Come on, Kev, we got to take this seriously."
Yeah, they do something like that. But in this case, I mean, I guess they used the Eddie's LWO, Genesis promo to kind of illustrate this point. But I suppose they always luck out in finding some great footage to go along with these stories.
One thing that WCW was great for, a lot of real life blending into storylines and making tons of pennies. And Vicky Guerrero here, she talked about the fact that Eddie Guerrero would bring a lot of these frustrations home with him. He went through this depression, just hated going to work. And Vicky thought the LWO was a great idea that brought competition to the NWO. Not a Nitro viewer, is what Vicky was pretty much saying.
Yeah,
here.
I don't know
about the LWO, some people will maybe look back at it. It was by no means serious.
I thought it was a cool shirt.
I guess. Didn't last too long. Yeah. And Jericho kind of sums up NWO as going from Black Sabbath to Spinal Tap within the course of 2 years. This was great because, again, there's a promo that's very well remembered that Bret Hart cut on El Dandy during this time period.
Oh, remind me. What happened?
Bret Hart was... He got to pick his opponent at the time, and he was the heel. And he's telling Gene Okerlund with a straight face that he wants to take on the legendary El Dandy. And Gene Okerlund is laughing it off, like, "El Dandy!" And Brett's just coming to El Dandy's defense of putting him over. And it's just this ridiculous promo that was hilarious. And they actually showed a clip of it in this. We went through the unmasking of Ray in February of 99.
Well, without actually showing his face.
Yeah, they got around that without showing his face here. One of a million mistakes the company made, but really by the end of it, I don't even know if it was in the top 100, but unmasking Ray in a tag match and WWF at least having the smart sense to put Ray behind a mask when they eventually brought him in. Mm-hmm. And Jericho states, "WWF was the place to go for young guys with a desire to make it. WCW was the place to go if you had already made it and you just want to make money." Wasn't too far off.
No, but it was at this point where I kind of felt like the story was...
It was just morphing into WCW is fucking stupid.
Yeah, and not so much about cruiserweights. And I get that the series is really about WCW versus WWF, but I don't know. It just felt like another criticism of the NWO again, you know?
We had Vince Russo, who talked about how the cruiserweights were nameless and faceless people, no personality, and that wrestling wasn't driving the product at the time.
I can't wait for that episode. I'm sure they're working on it.
I'm sure it'll happen. We had a. They tried to get over the how disorganized WCW was at the time, and emphasizing this by Tony Schiavone.
Oh, great!
Going to throw to a match, then getting a word in his earpiece, getting confused on the air, and then throwing to the match as the music began.
It's great that, you know, shows like these allow them the opportunity to kind of like make their own botchamanias on these episodes.
I would love to see the process of putting together some of this stuff, of like how they find some of these such obscure clips. Like, how would you remember that? You know what I mean? And know where to find it? Like, you have people just fucking shot listing everything.
I'm sure it's partly that. I'm sure they have an incredible archival system where
it must be amazing.
You type in Jericho and you probably
like WCW fuck ups. I'm sure it's just a folder of clips like this.
Maybe. But like, you know, and I'm sure the producers of these shows themselves are probably very incredibly knowledgeable fans.
And then we kind of get some bleed over from the Jericho episode as we talk about the Radicals leaving, which Vicky outlines the members, Eddie, Perry, and Dean coming over to the WWF. And we did see Benoit here showing in the front row when they attacked the New Age Outlaws their first night in. And then they kind of contrast to when the Radicals left WCW, they lost their key talent, and they had to replace it with acts like Kenny Chaos, who was never a significant character.
Yeah.
Disco Inferno, Three Count, the West Hollywood Blondes.
There was a lot of creative
liberties taken here. I mean, these characters were never, you know.
We're replacing Chris Benoit with Kenny Chaos.
That's like saying, you know, when you know, I don't know who would be the
when
equivalent.
When Hulk Hogan left, they replaced him with Duke Drosy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
No, it's silly.
And then,
I mean, and also, like, guys like Benoit and the Radicals, they weren't even in the Cruiserweight division at the time.
No, they weren't. And the final, like, 10 minutes of this is kind of where I didn't enjoy this, because this is when this narrative took place that WCW had all this talent, they squandered all of it, they came to the WWF, and they all became superstars.
And we lived and happily ever after.
It was such bullshit. Like, the idea, first of all, you know, you have Perry Saturn and Dean Malenko. They were never stars in WWF. They were never pushed as stars. They were never packaged as anything more than mid-card talent. Chris Benoit was fucking flagged his first week as a guy that, with the right talent, could be carried. Eddie Guerrero, I would say, was the guy they were most high on. Benoit, they certainly gave a number of main events to that year.
Yeah, I mean,
not a main event guy.
Well, the argument is that they both went on to become champions. Them and
they did, but they went through a ton of transition in WWF. And the same can be said. Rey Mysterio, they didn't even want this guy when WCW went out of business. It took him 18 months to finally bring Rey in at the urging of other talent on who had worked with the guy to bring him in. And then they use examples of like Billy Kidman coming to the WWF.
Becoming a big
what a star he became. Hurricane getting a roll up on The Rock as an indication that they created a star in the Hurricane.
Of all the WCW buyout guys, I'd say he's probably one of the more successful in the Cruiserweight division.
Like, the Hurricane?
Yeah.
He had a fine run.
In terms of Cruiserweights, I'm trying to think of who else from that
whole thing. It was funny. They constantly show Ultimo Dragon in this WCW B-roll and never once touch upon him coming into the WWE, where an uninspiring run. They do show Eddie Guerrero. Who?
And a slip.
Oh, yeah, of course, the famous WrestleMania 20 slip. They do show Eddie winning the title from Brock Lesnar and kind of in a roundabout way leading to Daniel Bryan winning the title at WrestleMania earlier this year.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
It led right
a perfect example of the WWF has completely changed their mindset because of these cruiserweights, and now they view talent like Daniel Bryan as being on par with all their other talent.
Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe there is something to that. You don't think? Okay, all right, but
it was smooth sailing. Once Daniel Bryan got over a year ago, I mean, he pretty much just
You're right.
He got in the fast lane. I mean, the main event.
You can look at really back at Bret and Shawn as you know examples of smaller guys kind of doing you know winning championships. But definitely towards the last 5 minutes of this whole thing, they really were rushing to find some type of happy ending.
Yeah, you know. And that's just the part that it's like if you didn't go through this period, like Benoit got his title and then he dropped it and he was gone from that main event scene. Yeah. I mean, he was never. I mean, there are guys that they have their They are completely behind, and these are going to be main event guys. And to me, Benoit was never that. Eddie came close. Eddie came close to being one of those guys, and his body just really, like, broke down. But, I mean, you look at it, Jericho, look at the struggle that guy went through. He didn't really feel like one of those key guys till 9 years after he came to the WWF. So the idea that WWF just, how could they waste all this talent in WCW? These are stars. Anything but the truth. Right. And Rey Mysterio, a perfect example of that.
Yeah.
One of the worst title reigns in history, I would go so far as to say.
So that's the show.
So that's the beautiful moment. Actually, there was one funny comment at the end. Justin Gabriel said, you know, when contrasting the cruiserweights to the bigger guys, says someone like Big Show, he's big and he's great, but he can't do a moonsault. And that was always the story, that Big Show actually could do a moonsault.
Right.
But it never happened on TV, so no one knows if that's just an urban legend or not. But that was always the story, that Big Show actually could do a moonsault. Did see him do a kip-up once.
Did you?
He's done one before.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if he can moonsault or kip-up right now.
The closing shot, actually, of Ray winning the title and saying, "We succeeded."
We did it,
guys. That was rich.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
I'm just saying, it's not always as clean a black and white story as some of these documentaries make it out to
be.
And I think there's more nuance you can add to some of the and the context.
Certainly. I think I chalk a lot of that up to, you know, simply the format, right? If you're given 15 minutes to talk about such a big topic, you're going to come up with a...
Then you download a podcast and find out more. We don't have a format.
I will say the ending was definitely kind of weak. And I think overall, I found the shows a little boring. I just don't necessarily...
Were they too long?
Yeah. I don't necessarily think that there's enough story here to...
Let's not forget, it's not just an hour. It doesn't sound that long. It's an hour commercial free.
50 minutes.
So, yeah, realistically, you're looking at something that would be like 90 minutes on TV.
Like, I personally just don't think that there's enough story to last the whole 50 minutes. I mean, the parts
on a singular topic.
No. Yeah. I mean, if you are going to, you know, do a longer show, I'd say the things that I was really engaged about was them talking about some of these high-profile matches or matches that, you know, a lot of people have forgotten about. There was, like, one point where they kind of spent a bit of time talking about Brian Pillman versus Jushin Liger as the show that kicked off Nitro. I thought that was, you know, both relevant to the topic of the show as well as, you know, the overall theme of the show.
Yeah, that was really just brushed over. They did show some highlights of it, but I mean, that was the match that kicked off. That was the match literally that started the Monday Night War.
Right, exactly.
And that's how that could have been positioned.
So, you know, some of the, I guess this one was a bit more relevant to the overall theme than Jericho was too, but the Jericho one really just kind of played out as the Chris Jericho documentary. This was at least a bit more to do with Nitro itself. You know, the shows are fine, but you're not going to find any new information here that if you're a longtime wrestling fan that you hadn't heard before. But if you are a brand new wrestling fan, go nuts. You'd probably love this.
And you can find out everything you want to know about The Rock on this week's show.
Yeah.
The Monday Night War.
So I give the shows, production's very good, but I'd say a little fluffy in terms of content. I give it a 6.5 out of 10.
I give it a 5. Yeah. So cool. Let's go to the feedback. We'll see what folks have to say about these shows. And we'll start off with Will from Arizona. Watching both of these shows about an era of wrestling that I was very involved in as a viewer, I walked away not being any more curious of Jericho, Mysterio, Juventud, the Luchadores, etc., yet very curious about one particular cruiserweight, semi-heavyweight, Eddie Guerrero. I want to ask John and Way a question about Eddie. First, let me give a rundown of Eddie from my view as a fan of both him and WCW. In the summer of 96, Eddie was a pay-per-view challenger to Ric Flair's U.S. title. In December of 96, Eddie was booked to win a tournament. Okay, this is a... like his career rundown here.
Question at the end.
What would you have done differently in booking Eddie Guerrero in WCW between 96 and 99? Do you really think he was ready for the next level, or did he really need the jump to WWE to further work on his character and reach new heights? I think the idea that he only developed that character like later in his career, if you weren't watching him, that character was certainly... I mean, contrast him in 96 to late 97 when he was that heel. That character was coming across extremely strong. And I think that if I could have done one thing differently, I think it wouldn't have just been with Eddie, but with Jericho, with a number of those guys, I would have tried to slowly mix them into that main event picture. Not necessarily make it mean like you're graduating from the cruiserweight division, but have a bit more leniency in terms of guys that can segue into that and try to book two strong titles with those two. And seeing some of these guys moved into that picture, and I think you would have had so many fresh matches. And I think a lot of these guys, the cruiserweights always get this label that they had no personalities, and history dictates that was really not accurate.
Yeah, especially with a guy like Eddie Guerrero. I mean, I certainly think that the fresh start really helped all those guys, you know, basically shed the image. Like, once they got into the WWE, I'm talking about Jericho, Benoit, Eddie, none of these guys were labeled as cruiserweights. I mean, I think WWE, that's part of their sort of prejudice, you know, against smaller guys. But they were smart enough to know that we don't want to label these guys at all as smaller people. And you never got that sense, you know, that they were smaller guys compared to anybody in the heavyweight roster. So I certainly think, you know, the jump helped, but I think the talent was always there, you know, with a guy like Eddie. We go to the Lack of Pants, who says, "Hi, guys. I used to watch wrestling around this era from the late 80s until shortly after Vinnie Mac bought WCW. I watched everything I could get my hands on and even listened to and read The Law online before anyone knew what a podcast was. I love cruiserweights, Bret Hart, and anyone else that could do backflips. I had three quick points about these particular episodes. One, who was the pre-Ray cruiserweight dressed in purple that they showed a bunch of with Malenko and Eddie?
Jerry Lynn.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Two, where was the elusive Blitzkrieg?
He was elusive. He wasn't showing.
Three, what do you guys know about Ralphus and where he came from?
He was a legitimate part of the WCW production crew in the back that they just utilized when Jericho introduced his personal security. And that's how he got the job. He was there anyway.
He also has a very long question, but I'll just go to one. He says, are we moving towards an age where people pay for their content directly, or will advertisers always insert themselves between consumers and creators?
I don't know what that's necessarily in reference to, though. Like,
your question's a bit too long.
All right, let's go to Martin from London. I had high hopes for the Monday Night War series when it was first announced, with an idea that it would trace key months of the war and what Raw and Nitro presented against each other at the time. Instead, these shows are pretty much redressings of several WWE DVD releases, with new talking heads adding to the existing footage. In fact, some of these interviews bleed into different shows when the same topics are brought up, and it's very annoying to watch as a result. That being said, the two episodes in question are two of the better ones. While not an obvious topic for a series like this, the WWE Cruiserweight division was the backbone of Nitro, providing the show with the quality in-ring action to back up the main event stars on top. Once the backbone was ripped out, with Jericho and the Radicals moving on to the WWF, Nitro's in-ring throughout the show just couldn't compete with what the WWF had to offer. That was true. One thing to say, though, this episode did sneak smack of the Cruiserweights carried Nitro for years, but then the WWF made them stars, which is the whole the winners tell the story mentality. As for the Jericho episode, while his Breaking the Code DVD and his first couple of books offer a more complete story, this episode focusing on his WCW and early WWF run serve as a fun reminder of all the cool stuff he did and some of the struggles he went through as well. I was interested in the part of the show where he visited the McMahons undercover while still under WCW contract, but once again it came off as WCW misused him, we made him world champion, though Jericho does admit the problems he went through early in his tenure and that it wasn't easy for him to get to the level he did. 7 out of 10 for the Cruiserweight show, 8 out of 10 for the Jericho episode.
We go to Brad from Halifax, who has a few quick pros and cons. Cons: it is clearly reused clips from other DVDs, and most of it you may have seen in other sets. The pros of the show are that the ratings graphics is likely not hard to do, but it makes me pop every time. Watching it reminds you of stuff to go back and watch on the network, working to keep people hawked. Seeing current wrestlers talk about watching it as kids out of character is very heartwarming and adds to those wrestlers as people. It was the best part of wrestling in the last 25 years and well worth the look back.
Over to David Duffenberg. This series the WWE has put out has been very entertaining thus far. The Cruiserweight episode might be my favorite. When I first got into watching WCW, those were the matches I looked forward to the most. It wasn't like anything I had ever seen before. I had zero access to ECW at the time, so these guys were all very fresh. Halfway through, I almost forgot WWE did their own version of it that flopped miserably. I didn't think a documentary type of review would have a Scott Putski Award winner, but the award's namesake made an appearance, so he wins for this review. They touched on the fact that the Cruiserweights would stay stuck as Cruiserweights, and I remember that bugging me back in the time as well. I wanted to see Ray or Malenko move up to bigger and better things, but they had that Cruiserweight stigma attached to them the whole time. The Jericho episode was a great trip down memory lane. My only gripe is he didn't really seem like a major factor in the ratings war. The Foley episode touched on when he won the world title and everyone switched over to that because of Schiavone's comment. The Austin episode pointed out how his televised match with Vince earned them a ratings victory. And of course, Goldberg's episode had the Hogan match for the ratings battle. Jericho was awesome, but he never seemed to swing the ratings. When he had big segments, it was when WWE had a monster ratings lead on WCW. Yes, he turned out to be one of the biggest stars ever, but for the Monday Night War concept, he just isn't somebody I associate with that. Overall, I'm giving the series an 8 out of 10. Wondering what other concepts they focus on for this show, and if they focus on when Russo took over taking over at all.
Okay. Finally, Derek from Denton says, these are two episodes of the Monday Night War that I really enjoyed because I love the Cruiserweight division and Chris Jericho is one of my favorite wrestlers. I was happy to hear that the bigger wrestlers actually did enjoy watching the Cruiserweights go out and put on great matches, as well as the fact that they should have been treated better. The reason why I got into the Cruiserweights was when I was a kid. It was the first time I saw them, and they reminded me of Power Rangers because of their athleticism and wrestling gear. I hope that soon the WWE will start to add more Monday Nitro episodes so that I can watch more Cruiserweight matches that are not on YouTube and very hard to find. I thought it was pretty funny that the WWE decided to put Scott Putski in their light heavyweight division. Is there anything from the Monday Night Wars that you guys would like to see in an episode?
Well, Way clearly wants to see one episode and one episode only.
Yeah, pretty much. How about you? What's a topic that you would personally like to see them cover? Don't think about the audience. Don't think about, you know, any legal.
I'm trying to. I don't know if there's any particular angle I'm that fixated on seeing them cover on the Monday Night War.
How about just one specific angle?
Okay, how about this one? Where did all the WCW fans go? How you had 12 million people at its peak watching wrestling in 1998, and we fast forward to 6 months after WCW goes out of business, and about under six are watching wrestling on Monday nights. Where did all those people go? Mm. I would be fascinated to hear a WWE point of view.
Where did all the people
go? A lot of deaths occurred. Our wrestling fans died off.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for all of your feedback. You can always leave feedback for all of our shows at lawradio.proboards.com. That is also where we house our archives. Are you aware we have archives, Wei?
I'm well aware.
I go back. I listen to Wei Ting talk about wrestling every single day. The archives of all our episodes are up there that you can check out. Next week, we will be back with a brand new review. And I put it out on Twitter of what events people want to see us review in the month of November. And we got a lot of votes for a ECW November to Remember, a Battle Bowl event from WCW, which was the Lethal Lottery Tournament from November of 93. I'm looking here at others. A few Survivor Series votes, some for Cyber Sunday. Are there any that stand out to you, Wei, as something you would like to watch?
Not really.
For next week?
No, not really.
Do you want to just pick anything then?
Yeah, you go ahead.
What would... If we're going by the democratic process, I believe that ECW got the most votes. So do you want to go with a November to Remember?
Sure.
Well, let's, in the spirit of the Montreal Screwjob, let's review November to Remember, which took place the week before the Survivor Series of 97.
Oh, wow.
And see...
So we've moved on to things that happened the week before now.
Yes. Let's see what else was happening in the world of wrestling.
We've already talked about that week, everything to do with that one event and that week so much, we got to move on.
Maybe we'll see some hints on the ECW pay-per-view that maybe someone in the WWF watched and that planted a seed for them of how they were going to book this match the following Sunday in Montreal. Maybe.
What's on the show?
That show has, as we look it up here, this would have been before they were on pay-per-view in Canada at the time. So I've never seen this show. Full disclosure.
November to remember.
God. We have a terrible internet set up here. Well. Oh, you know what? You know what's funny? It takes place after Montreal.
Oh, okay.
It takes
That's
place
right.
like 3 weeks afterwards. So we're not going to get any fucking clues.
So we could delete the whole past.
Maybe they're going to be reacting to Montreal on this particular show. November 30th of 97, Monica, Pennsylvania, at the Golden Dome. Shane Douglas, Bam Bam Bigelow for the ECW title. The Sandman against Sabu. A flag match between Tommy Dreamer and Rob Van Dam. Oh, boy. Do you want to review this?
Yeah,
no, you don't.
I do.
We can change, Wei.
I do want to. Why wouldn't I?
Or do you want to review the 99 version that has RVD, Taz's final match in ECW, Mike Awesome, Masato Tanaka.
Yeah, and?
And then the main event, Rhino and the Impact Players against Sandman, Dreamer, and Raven.
I think that one sounds... Which one sounds better to you?
It doesn't really matter to me, Wei.
Let's do... I actually like the...
How about 98, which features Jake Roberts? It also has a singles match with Lance Storm and Jerry Lynn.
Yeah.
This looks like a better show.
Sure.
Let's go with 98. From New Orleans, Louisiana, the site of WrestleMania 30.
What was the arena?
The Lakefront Arena. November 1st, 98. A full year after the Montreal screw job. 1 week shy of the anniversary.
Yeah. Let's see how the screw job affects.
Let's see a 1 year retrospective. Okay. We have just flip-flopped between three November to Remembers. We have settled on November to Remember 98 from the Lakefront Arena in New Orleans. So that will be our review for next week.
Are you sure?
You know what? Let's take a look at 94. JT Smith and Hack Myers. My goodness. All right. We're going with 98. 98. Okay. We will chat with you next week. And here, to end things off, we're going to listen to some music right now.
That I liked never got any recognition. Here is a character that I'm very attached to, and to see him not progress is just like, one, it's frustrating, two, you lose interest. Even though he's having great matches, you lose interest because this match doesn't mean anything. He can win this match, he can lose this match, it doesn't make a difference. He's not going to move up the card.